Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Broadcasting live from our studios in New York City and video streaming live from the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, the fastest growing internet in the world, and the number one place for independent and progressive, humanistic, and spiritually minded people. Everyone's invited to our table. As a result, we have young, middle-aged, and old people from all walks of life, from nuns and priests and rabbis, and imams to atheists and agnostics, because everyone deserves to know what's going on other than the official positions taken by the mainstream media and even the alternative media. I can't differentiate today the Huffington Post from the New York Post, and that's unfortunate. I would have thought the people on the left and the people on the right would have been more concerned about being honest about the real problems and the real solutions. And they're not. So we try to fill in the void. Today, you'll see how we do that. Ted Rall. Don't know who he is? Well, you're not alone, because he's not in the mainstream media. But he's a twice recipient of the Robert Kennedy Journalism Award. He is also a Pulitzer Prize-winning finalist. And he is a person who has some thoughts on charting a roadmap for a country in economic and political collapse. An anti-American manifesto. You won't hear him on the Sean Hannity show, because he believes we have problems and there are solutions, but the solutions don't lie in front of us. He is the author of Wake Up, You Liberal, How Can We Take Back America from the Right? So that's what we're going to talk about. All this week, every single day, a total of 16 hours of live broadcast, I will be doing special commentaries, either by myself or from myself or others, or a combination of the two, all on the same thing, the coup d'etat, economic coup d'etat, right in front of us, not in secret, with virtual indifference by the mainstream media, complicit, and the left and the right. Today, Scenarios for the Coming Collapse of the American Empire by Alfred McCoy from Tom Dispatch, and he is a professor of history, University of Wisconsin-Madison. Also, I'll be going in depth today about new information I presented earlier today from mainstream science, that they're finally acknowledging vaccines are neither safe nor effective, and why. Before, they would not acknowledge that. Today, they did. So we're going to build on that. And I'll also do something today that you have not heard of before, and that is I'll be quoting some material verbatim from David Friedman's article, Lies, Damn Lies, Medical Science, in the Atlantic Monthly, about how we ended up with so much bad science, almost 80% of all studies you cannot trust. How's that possible? Then what are we supposed to trust? We'll go into that in depth. Also today, you were told by the CDC and the FDA and the U.S. Public Health Service and everyone else in power, the reason we do not have major diseases, infectious diseases at least, is because the enormously important immunization programs. Well, there's only one problem. They have no proof on their side. But I'm holding in my hands the most comprehensive set of official documents of charts from public health research from Dr. Raymond Amswanen, showing that before any major disease had a vaccine, it was already 95 to 100% gone. Therefore, to say the vaccine ended the disease is simply wrong. Also, today, for the first time, I've never seen it before, but I've studied the charts. It shows who's more likely to get sick, those who've never been vaccinated or those who were fully vaccinated. And it will surprise you. But this is the first time in an exclusive you'll see this, all based upon good science. None of this is speculative. None of this is from anti-vaccine advocates. It's good science. Let us begin. We have a lot to share. From Drexel University College of Nursing and Health Professionals, an interesting study that showed that listening to music benefits patients. And mechanical ventilation often causes major distress and anxiety in patients. The sensation of breathlessness and frequent suctioning and the inability to talk and uncertainty regarding surroundings or condition or discomfort or isolation from others and fear all contribute to high levels of anxiety. Medications administered to reduce anxiety can lead to increased hospital stays, medical costs, and kill the person. But a new study showed that listening to music, soft music, relaxing music, benefited the patients by reducing anxiety, which led to fewer complications. Quote, with all these factors making mechanical ventilation a highly stressful experience, it is exciting that music may provide a way to reduce anxiety in those patients without costly side effects. And that was based upon data from 213 patients in total that were studied in 8 trials where they looked at how a person was breathing and their discomfort and their anxiety, and then they played this music, and that de-stressed them, making breathing easier. So, that's good news. Next up, early death risk increases with body mass index. Now, because I read the original scientific studies and extrapolate information and present it in lay language, it's always ahead of the curve, always before you would read it, for instance, in the New York Post, or excuse me, the Washington Post in Washington, because we have a lot of people listening on WPFW, our sister station, where I'm approaching 25 years on the air. Here's what this says. This is in the New England Journal of Medicine, the current issue. A large analysis confirms the relationship between being overweight or obese and dying from all causes during a 10-year follow-up. The National Cancer Institute, Dr. Gonzalez, along with a team of colleagues from the United States, Australia, and other nations, took a look at 19 prospective studies totaling 1,462,958 white male and female participants between 19 and 84. Then they measured the person's body fat. And then they determined that if you were fat or obese, you had a much greater chance of dying, a substantial increase in dying. Quote, in white adults overweight or obese, there's an increased all-cause mortality. And all-cause in general mortality is lowest at 20.0 to 24.9%. Well, this would freak him out. I'm at 2.3% according to a body index mass impedance test last week. Now, I'm a marathon runner. I work out with weights. I do intense Olympic-style training, so it's not surprising my body at 190 pounds total weight, 6'2", and that low a body weight. But for me, that's healthy because I take in healthy fats every day. Now, if I wasn't an athlete and I wasn't exercising every part of my body with the type of intense high-resistance exercise, like I'll get on a VersaClimber, put it at the highest resistance, and work out for an hour. I'll run up 25 flights of stairs 25 times. And do power biking at the highest resistance nonstop. That really burns fat, and it strengthens muscle. But let's just say you're a normal athlete. I feel that your body percentage of fat should be no more than 12%. And for the average man, I believe you should not be above 14%. For the average woman, I believe you should be below 15%. You're going to live a longer life. You're going to have less disease. You're going to find that you have more energy. So even though they're showing that you will live longer at 20 to 25%, that's simply taking the average of the person who is not obese and saying, well, this is a good thing. No, it's like taking a cholesterol of 200 and saying, if you could only get to 200 on your cholesterol, that would be better. Yeah, that's if everyone else is 300, but why not get down to about 125? Oh, because you're not vegan and you're not eating raw and you're not exercising, you're not eating your supplements, you're not going to get down there. But if you did, your blood sugar profile, the inflammatory agents would be less. So the good news is that they're at least telling people if you're fat, you're going to die early. Period. Listen to what I just said. You cannot be fat, you cannot be overweight and be healthy. You will die earlier. Because just being overweight by itself causes more inflammation. Even if it doesn't manifest immediately or in the near term in a major clinically definable disease. Long before you can measure a tumor, long before you end up with a stroke or heart attack, long before you have swelling in the joints or brittling of the bones, demineralization, you're in the process of getting there. It'd be much like saying, here I am in San Francisco or L.A., but you were in New York. Well, I'm now here. There's no such thing as in between. And unfortunately, that is the lack of honesty or just awareness within medicine that all diseases are a process. You're saying a person's healthy because you cannot discern a clinically obvious set of symptoms. And I'm saying you're wrong. You're all wrong all the time. Always. You cannot say that a person wakes up and suddenly has cancer or just happened to have a heart attack today for no other reason than they had a heart attack today for no other reason. I'm saying they had a heart attack today because of all of the mitigating cofactors that over a period of years or decades accumulated, causing such damage to the mitochondria and the epithelial tissue and the scarring and the lesions and the blockage to one day the heart simply could not maintain itself and tipped into pathology, manifesting in an ischemic episode. Why is it medicine just refuses to look at the truth? Possibly because of this. Once you're honest about what causes everything in life, then you must be aware that everything you do, all the time, causes an outcome. You can more often than not control your action. You have absolutely no control whatsoever over the reaction. So you can smoke a cigarette, and you can drink alcohol, and you can eat a hamburger and french fries and a pizza, and sit and watch ball game and have beers. You can do all that. You cannot control the 1 million cells that will die because of the alcohol that day. You cannot control the prostaglandins and the cytokines and all the other 40 to 50 uniquely destructive inflammatory agents that will happen when you have the cheeseburger, the barbecued ribs, the pizza. You have no control. And you'll get away with it until you can't. But by the time you realize there's something wrong, you're at the end stage of a disease, not the beginning. At the end stage of a disease process, then you're going to say, oh my God, what's this? Well, it's what you created by all those choices you felt weren't important. And when enough people, by consensus, decide that they don't want to do something, or they will do something that is non-healthy, the fact that you have a lot of people making the same wrong choice doesn't give you any comfort when they too, along with you, are sickened. So what if medicine simply took a different position and said that every single action in life has a consequence? This whole idea that there is no consequence because nobody can see it, nobody can hear it, nobody can feel it. That's much like taking a nap in a garage that has a motor running. You won't see, you won't feel, and you won't taste the carbon monoxide. But it'll kill you. So I just think that we have been intellectually dishonest. I believe that we're functioning at a primal and limbic level. And I believe we have disguised the conceit, the hubris, the arrogance of academic achievement and career fulfillment with wisdom. And I believe we are grossly lacking wisdom. How anybody can get paid for having a patient die is beyond me. Now, on the good side of this, more information that supports making the right choices. Physical activity slows aging. This is the latest. This is a major study in Germany. And here's what they say. And this was in Deutsches Arbeit International. They found that older individuals who were running, exercising, training, found that they had substantially improved conditioning, and especially between the ages of 50 and 70. They remained fit, they had greater physical performance, they had less biological aging processes. But it meant that they followed 600,000 marathoners and half marathoners. And so the more long-distance training you do, biking is fine, jogging, power walking, swimming, the longer you're going to live. It slows down the aging process. And finally, green tea increases post-meal satiety. That's important because a lot of people, after a meal, and not long after a meal, 2 or 3 hours after, they feel hungry again. But they're not. The food still is in their stomach. It hasn't even left the stomach. And they're already eating something else. Here's the latest nutrition journal. A study done at Lund University in Sweden by Dr. Josic says, quote, drinking green tea after a meal can boost satiety levels, even though it doesn't affect glucose levels or glycemic levels. It does create a sense of satiety. They don't know why. Maybe it's some of the polyphenol compounds called catechins. That's merely speculative, but that could be one of the reasons. In any case, green tea after a meal, and you feel more full. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Ted Roll talking about charting a roadmap for a country in economic and political collapse, an anti-American manifesto, coming at you in a few moments. Also beginning a series of commentaries on the coming collapse of the American empire. Not good news to hear. Most people don't want to hear this, but I believe they must hear it because the solution is in understanding how we're getting there so you can get out of harm's way. That is from Professor Alfred McCoy from Tom's Dispatch. I'll give you that. But before we go there, some new information. For those of you who are watching this over ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, you can see I have in my hand a series of graphs, immunization graphs, from a doctor, Raymond Obswanin, a senior advisor for First Nations Center. And in here, we have natural infectious disease declines preceding public immunization efforts. Let me quote this. It says, figures 1 through 11 graphically illustrate that in North America, Europe, and the South Pacific, major declines in life-threatening infectious diseases occurred historically either without or far in advance of public immunization efforts for specific diseases as listed. This provides irrefutable evidence that vaccines are not necessary for the effective elimination of a wide range of infectious diseases. Then we go to specifics. By the way, we posted this on GaryNall.com and VaccineInitiative.com. That's a site that we have dozens of new articles. In fact, anyone who's doing anything who is has good scholarship, that has good documentation, is then given an opportunity to present their data on Vaccine Initiatives, the website. So here we have it. Now let me go through some of these. And those of you who are listening, I'll make it as graphic as possible. First, we have tuberculosis. Death rates per 100,000 from 1880 to 1960. So we're dealing with an 80-year period. Now, it was at the highest in 1880. And at that point, you had 200 people dying from tuberculosis per 100,000. That's very high. And then there was a really gradual decline until about 1922, and then it leveled off for about 6 years, then another steep decline until 1948, then a very dramatic decline down to about 30 per 100,000 dying, and that's when they introduced the vaccine, the BCG vaccine for tuberculosis. So here's what you have to understand. There was a 93% reduction in death by tuberculosis before the tuberculosis vaccine was introduced. That's that. The next is the measles vaccine. Now, the highest incidence of measles death on this chart from 1935 to 1983 was in 1935. You had 800 people dying per every 100,000. But there was an enormously steep decline in the next 12 years. Now, when the vaccine, live vaccine, was introduced in 1963 and the inactive in 1964, it was down to about 40 people. So we went from 800 down to 40. That's over a 95% reduction. So for them to say, well, my goodness, we eliminated vaccine and eliminated measles death from vaccines. No, you didn't. Over a 50-year period, improving sanitation, improving nutrition, improving labor standards and working conditions, and healthier water supplies, pasteurization of milk. That's what caused this, not the vaccine. Again, this is irrefutable proof. Next up... Well, I have another chart there. Let me see. That's tuberculosis again. And then we have the pertussis. It was at the highest in 1918. And it was way down by 90% when the pertussis vaccine was introduced in 1948. So we had gone down 90%. Again, scarlet fever. Scarlet fever killed the most people. In 1910, the vaccine was introduced. And no, there was no vaccination for scarlet fever adopted in the United States. But by 1958, it was gone. I mean, gone. So from 1910 to 1958, once again, we show, without a vaccine, it was gone. Then we have, let's see, we have, it's the same one. Vaccine. I have that in children. This is interesting. This is in England and Wales. Pertussis death cases in children under 15 from 1850 to 1965. And it shows that in 1850, they had a massive 1,400 deaths per 100,000. That's a lot of kids dying. And the vaccine was introduced in 1950. It was down to almost zero. Once again, what causes sharp decline? The sharpest decline occurred between 1900 and 1950. Once again, we're looking at child labor laws. Children weren't forced to work at that point because of the unions. But before that, we forget, Americans forget that we had massive amounts of children working, frequently 10 to 12-hour days. They were given small compensation. They were working in terrible industries, the coal industry, the steel industry, agriculture, and they were dying. They also didn't have pasteurized milk. They didn't have clean water. So this is what I'm showing you now. And then I also have scurvy and pertussis in England before the vaccine, which was in 1950 55, you had a 98% gone, and this is in children, almost 100% gone before the measles vaccine was introduced. So I have all these charts here, and then I have something interesting that I've never seen before, and this is the first time these charts. I want to introduce these charts to you before we go to our guest. This is a figure from this scientist, and it says, figure 11 through 24 graphically illustrate that immunization is not by any means a proven and foolproof measure of protection from various infectious disease conditions. It is often inconsequential epidemiology, and in some cases it is shown to actually worsen healthcare outcomes. And then it shows inactivated influenza vaccine, children under 2 years of age, the Cochrane collaboration database of systemic reviews. By the way, that's the most prestigious scientific review group in the world. Of 260,000 children, the effectiveness, zero. You heard me right, zero effectiveness. Now, this is according to the latest study, which was 2006 by the Cochrane Collaboration Group. Now, the elderly living in communities and group homes, nursing homes, assisted living centers, the inactivated influenza vaccine, its effectiveness, zero. All right? This is the first time we've seen these studies. Now, the BCG for tuberculosis, randomized controlled trial of a single BCG, repeated BCG or combined BCG and killed Mycobacterium leprae vaccine for prevention of leprosy and tuberculosis, published in the British Medical Journal of The Lancet, volume 348, issue 9019, page 17 to 24. Effectiveness of the vaccine, zero. Boy, I wish Bill Gates, Bill Clinton, their foundations, and the people they surround themselves with from the pharmaceutical industry would be honest for one day in their lives. Stop thinking your vaccine programs are effective in saving people. With the best of intentions, you're not doing anything to help them. And the studies show it. And this is an exclusive first on this program. Now for tuberculosis, figure 15. This is a, in years, birth to 2.5 years, the vaccinated had double the increase in tuberculosis from the vaccines. So not only was the vaccine not effective, zero effectiveness, there was a 250% increase in, or 200% increase in tuberculosis from those getting the vaccines. And the source, double-blind, randomized, controlled trial, BCG effectiveness in 250,000 subjects, Tuberculosis Research Center, the Indian Journal of Medical Research, volume 110, page 56 to 69. Again, peer-reviewed literature, a major study showing you not only did not help a child, you actually had a 200% increase in giving the child the disease that you were supposedly inoculating them from. Mumps outbreak in highly vaccinated population. Center for Disease Control, May 26, 2006, page 559 to page 563, volume 55. Quote, mumps outbreak in highly vaccinated population. 92% were vaccinated. And who got the outbreak of mumps? The 92% who were vaccinated. 8% who were unvaccinated got the mumps. So if you got the vaccines, all your vaccines for mumps, in this group, 92% got the mumps. Chickenpox outbreak in highly vaccinated population. Source Pediatrics, volumes 113, number 3, page 455. The group that were not vaccinated, 3%. Got the chickenpox. 97% who were vaccinated got the chickenpox. Pertussis outbreak in highly vaccinated population. Source, Vaccine Safety Manual, and from the CDC, the official surveillance data, page 140, 2008. Vaccinated group that got the pertussis, 90%. Unvaccinated, 10%. Measles outbreak in highly vaccinated population. New England Journal of Medicine, volume 316, number 13, page 771 to 774. those who got the measles who were fully vaccinated, 99% of those who got the measles have been fully vaccinated. Those who were not vaccinated, 1% of those not vaccinated got the measles. So those are some of the studies, and I have over 40 pages. All of these are up there. We also have studies that we have not seen before, and these are fully documented in deaths in under age 5 from influenza after the CDC mandates flu vaccines in early childhood. And it was very low from 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002. And then in the latter half of 2002, the CDC mandates early childhood flu vaccines in the United States. It went from 10 deaths to 90. And the report is from the CDC, Vital Statistics Reports. And and then pertussis vaccine and sudden infant death syndrome, when it was not mandated, there was low percentage. When it was, it skyrocketed by over 90%. And so it goes with each of these. So average incidence, first 5 years of life, and it goes through different countries showing those who got ear infections non-vaccinated, it was 0.5%. Those who vaccinated, almost 2%. Inflammation of the throat, aggressive behavior, compulsive collapse, antibiotic administered, always more in the vaccinated than in the non-vaccinated. So now we have a much clearer picture of why people are being told you must vaccinate in order not to become infected. And we're showing their studies, their research, their publications, but not reported anywhere in the media. Not the left media, shame on them. Not the right media, shame on them. No one is touching Big Pharma. No one is challenging the CDC. No one has the courage to go up against these people. Yet there's the studies. Now, I'm a PhD in human nutrition and public health science. I'm a professor at Fairleigh Dickinson. I'm a scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology for over 30 years. I'm a journalist. If I can read this stuff, and if I can find the truth in this, why can't all the other doctors and journalists and scientists in America? What is going on? Tomorrow, I'll discuss what's going on. An article by Daniel Friedman in The Atlantic, Lies, Damn Lies, Medical Science. This is startling. This answers the next question. If everything I just told you and showed you comes from their literature, official studies, and they're not paying attention to it, they're producing toxic effects, they're not protecting the public health, then why are they still doing it? Why isn't this being challenged somewhere, anywhere? And it's not. No legislators, the media, the institutions of Congress, and the official government organizations, nowhere. And yet the truth is being denied. And this is not the first time this happened. It's happened many times. Synthetic hormone replacement therapy for women, terrible what it does, yet it's still in use. We'll talk about that tomorrow. We have to go to our guest now, who's been patiently standing by. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Keep on pushing. Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. I'd like to welcome all of you once again. I'm Gary Knoll. Ted Rawl is my guest. I gave his introduction earlier about twice recipient of the Robert Kennedy Journalism Award and a Pulitzer Prize finalist and nationally syndicated cartoonist columnist, and he's worked as an overseas war correspondent. He is the author of Wake Up, You're Liberal, How Can We Take Back America from the Right?, which challenges the liberals to step forward and challenge the system, something I haven't seen. Well, maybe I missed it. Nice to have you with us, Ted.
Thanks to have me, but I hope you talk about a book that's still in print, which is my new one, The Anti-American Manifesto. Wake Up, You're Liberal came out 6 years ago.
Yeah, and I had mentioned the Anti-American Manifesto earlier on in the show.
Okay, good.
So we're on the
just
same page.
Just wanted to make sure. Okay, good. All right,
here's the issue for me. Is whether Americans are ready to bond together to launch a truly coordinated assault on the system of corporate governance or whether we do nothing, wait for the entire system to implode that would likely lead to chaos, fragmented ideologies and revolt, and very probably rampant crime by those who have been disenfranchised for decades. So first, I would like to hear your synopsis of our current political and cultural climate that has sowed the ground for popular revolt in this country. And the last thing I want to see is Glenn Beck dressed as Elmer Gantry, holding a Bible in one hand and assailing some industry that he is profiting from on the others, all the while his minions are behind him thinking he is the right person. That's scary to me. Your thoughts, please.
Well, the answer to your first question is no, Americans are not ready to rise up, and that's because there is literally no opposition whatsoever to the existing system, whether that's in the media or that's in the political arena. The current situation is so fraught with peril that it is hard to say exactly what will bring the system down first, whether it's environmental collapse or it's governmental collapse, political collapse, or just simple government bankruptcy caused by excessive debt. It's hard to know whether we're going to suffer a terrible example of blowback that makes 9/11 look like a joke. Who knows what it's going to be? All we know for sure is that the current system seems and feels unsustainable to most Americans, whether they are on the left or on the right. And what is also very clear is that the system is not in any shape to right itself or to respond. This book came into being after Obama was elected in November of 08. He came into power 2 months into this current economic collapse that continues and is a depression by any kind of rational measure. And here you are 2 years later with a president who doesn't even propose something that is in the form of a jobs bill, not even a lame or a bad jobs bill. There is no talk of using the government to create jobs. Now, whether you think the government should create jobs or not, that is sort of beside the point. The point is that it is not normal for a government faced with rising unemployment and the social unrest that surely will follow such an event to not try to directly employ some Americans to try to ease the political pressure. The fact that they can't do that, that they can't even think about it, indicates to me that the system is no longer in a situation that similar to the 1930s, where FDR was able to marshal the resources of the federal government, not to end the Depression, because World War II did that, but to save itself. That this system cannot save itself. And so the current, so very clearly, we don't know exactly how the collapse will come because there's so many possible causes, and it might be something that, you know, I can't even anticipate right now. But what is clear is that it's completely non-responsive, that it's completely unable to turn on a dime and right itself, and that the American public is desperately seeking a solution outside of the plutocracy, outside of the Democrats and the Republicans that support it. And that solution, if you really think it through, has to start with removing the current two-party system. And in order to do that, you have to look at the R word. And I don't mean Republican, I mean revolution.
All right. Of course, we must also keep in the context of your discussion that the Fed did move on a dime. It was extremely creative in giving $3.3 trillion immediately to over 10,000 on 10,000 different transactions, as we just found out from companies like McDonald's and Verizon, banks all over Europe, and all the major banks. In fact, every single major banking and Wall Street firm lined up to get part of that $3.3 trillion, and as now we know, no collateral was given, no obligation in its time repayment, and zero interest. It got it at 0.25%, which is zero interest, which it then turned around and using credit cards and buying other properties and loaning the government back even money itself at 3%. So Someone was very creative and very positive in helping a very small number of people, but it seems like they forgot the average American in the process. So here's my question. Recently, I had on Morris Berman. Are you familiar with Morris, the author of The Dark Age Americas?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, basically, it said that the twilight period of America's demise, when there was still a splinter of hope, has passed, and the U.S. has fundamentally entered a dark age of no return until after catastrophe and breakdown, and reform of the system is impossible. And in fact, he says the system is not even worth reforming, and any reform that takes place will essentially do nothing. Your thoughts on this, please?
Well, I haven't read his book, but I agree with what you have just the characterizations that you've just listed of it. Yeah, the system is not worth reforming. It is unreformable. It's finished. And you know, to speak to your point about the so-called bank bailouts, it's certainly not true that the government didn't do anything. They certainly did give away trillions of taxpayer dollars to banks and other large corporations. It was an excuse. They saw this economic collapse as another opportunity, in the same way that Bush saw the 9/11 as an opportunity to take away our rights, open up internment camps, start wars against Afghanistan and Iraq. It was an opportunity. Those things, you know, did not address 9/11, as we can tell. Bin Laden is still free. But what they did is they followed it. There was no causality, and it was certainly not, but it was an opportunity. And it's the same thing. Bush and Obama definitely saw the September 08 fiscal crisis as an opportunity to line the pockets of their wealthy friends. They didn't forget the American people. They view the American people as an inconveniencing trifle to be dealt with and conned every 2 to 4 years at election time, and the rest of the time to be ignored and laughed at.
I'm sure you have heard Bill Riley and Sean Hannity and Michael Savage Mark Levin and these other people state, I mean emphatically, that if you're either against the war, then you're against our troops and you're anti-American. But there are many Americans today who call themselves anti-American, but then they qualify that statement. They would say that they are pro-America based upon the principles it was founded upon, but anti-America towards what America has become as a corporate militarist empire. So share with us how a person can be both pro and anti-American, and why they shouldn't fear what the radicals like O'Reilly, who are always pro-military, they never question them, they never question the integrity or the credentials or background or bias of the military people they have on when talking about a war, and the only solution for them is more and more war and more troops, the Billy Crystal mindset, and how you can challenge all this but still be, in the comfort of your soul, an American. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the cradle of liberty. I like pizza and the Ramones and hamburgers, and I always miss home. I'm American. I'm quintessentially American. To hate America would be to hate myself. It's to be anti-American in the sense of the post 9/11 term or in the sense of the 1950s term is coding for being against the policies of the U.S. government. Well, I am against the policies of the U.S. government. I think the U.S. government sucks. So I'm anti-American in that sense. The name of the book was originally the Post-American Manifesto, and it was the central thesis was that we were headed towards collapse, that the system, that the right would be best poised to take over after the collapse, and that the left should do it first in order to avoid that. So that's really where the book is coming from, and it occurred to me that it would be called anti-American, and there is no better way to neutralize an insult than to take it for your own, which is, you know, kind of like the fat kid in school who calls himself fat, and everyone says, no, you're not fat. So I thought I would name the book The Anti-American Manifesto, and it's really worked, and it also helps neutralize that stupid word, which the right likes to trot out every time you criticize their wars or their runaway crazy corporate greed. You know, I mean, I don't even understand really, truly, how people like Rush Limbaugh could live with themselves. I don't have a problem with being conservative politically. I have a lot of conservative friends. But that kind of knee-jerk trust the government hypocrisy is just beyond belief to me. How can you possibly claim that you like small government and then support policies that radically expand it and its powers, not only in the U.S., but around the world? I don't see it. I don't get it.
Most of us don't. There has been a lot of criticism about those who consider them or call themselves liberal or democratic, but have not actualized that concern that they have on social issues in any meaningful way. I've had Chris Hedges many times. In fact, I'm going to be filming Chris out in Princeton later this week and Gerald Salante up in Kingston later this week. And they believe that many of the liberals who have historically stood for challenging the excesses of the military-industrial complex and helping the poor and the environment, that they have been virtually inept in challenging the system. Now, here's my concern and my question. Among the many different segments of American society who are angry, legitimately so, with Washington and Wall Street, there's yet to be, at least from my perspective, any bridge building between them to find common cause for uniting their efforts. In large part, it's clear the government and corporations and media want it that way, and make every effort to assure that it doesn't happen, that left and right doesn't meet, the conservatives and liberals don't meet, nor the coasts meet the heartlands. And it's probably true that the Christian ideology that permeates components of the radical right, such as a large portion or at least a portion of the Tea Party, makes it difficult for the progressives to meet at the same table with them. But what do you see as the main elements for why the right and left have been unable to meet and work together, and why we have more registered independents and progressives than liberals and Democrats combined, or conservatives and Democrats combined, and yet they're virtually impotent at this time?
The right and the left have always, in all situations, historically, in the United States and at other times and places, have always obviously had cultural and ideological gaps separating them. So I don't think that's new. I think what happens in crisis periods, though, is that the system, when the system becomes monstrous and in need of being resisted, when you have a healthy culture of nonconformity, the left and right can form a pact of convenience in order to fight the government. And in fact, I call for that in the Anti-American Manifesto. I say that there's no reason why a hipster from Bushwick shouldn't be able to work with a Nazi skinhead from Idaho if they share the same basic goals. As Shah Ahmed Massoud said back during the 1980s when he helped unite the anti-Soviet resistance in Afghanistan, he said, first we kill the Russians, next we kill each other. In other words, you have an alliance of convenience, and then later you fight for control after you create the power vacuum that results from revolution. Well, in the same situation occurred in Nazi-occupied Europe, where, for instance, in France, the resistance was composed of communists on the left and monarchists on the far right. And they were able to work together against the Nazis because they realized that the goal of overthrowing the Nazi occupiers was more important than fighting each other. We need to get to that place here. Of course, it's hard for the right to even know who they would make a deal with on the left, since the left is so incredibly factionalized, disorganized, and in some ways non-existent. I mean, you can't really count the official progressive left, you know, The Nation, Katrina Vandenhoevel, Progressive Magazine, Mother Jones, NPR, Axis of Militant Liberalism, with a real left. It's not. We don't have really any mainstream political force in that is anywhere left of center in the United States. So you can't count something, you know, a corporatist pseudo left like, you know, Arianna Huffington. So if the right were to get together, say, okay, all right, we'll come and talk to you guys. I don't know who they'd reach out to, but I think things are going to change quickly, and there's going to be all sorts of new forms of organization that are going to come together, that are going to emerge from the crisis as a result of the crisis. And that's kind of what I'm counting on.
Okay. Ted Rall, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming on and sharing your points of view with us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
The Anti-American Manifesto and website RALL.com. I'm Gary Noll. I've saved the last 5 minutes of our program for you to call in and share your points of view. Agree, disagree, this is an open forum, and I respect freedom of speech. And this is a forum for freedom of speech. Give us a call at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. As you call in on this issue, only on this issue, I'd like to hear from you. Now, I did not have a chance today to get to the coming collapse of the American Empire. I will tomorrow. I have a very powerful commentary to share with you tomorrow about the recipe for fascism. It is here and alive and well in our country today. Also tomorrow, lies, damn lies, medical science. Why we can have very failed medical procedures and drugs that are proven not to work, and yet they're still in mainstream medicine, still being used, either doing no good or harming people, and it's not removed. Why not? I'll get to that on tomorrow's program. Now, just a quick preview of upcoming guests. Well, no, we have Alan from Brooklyn. As calls come in, I'll take them. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Very good afternoon. I saw a very interesting special on the computer, one of the sites, that in 2012 there's supposed to be phenomenal sun storms, that the radiation is supposed to burn out the electrical grid in all over the world, and that the governments are actually building bunkers, underground bunkers, to protect the elite and the government. And I really think maybe this is something that's possibly going to happen. And quite frankly, I don't think they give a damn except for themselves.
We do know that there are going to be environmental challenges. This is not in question. It's about how bad will it be and where will it manifest. I'm doing a program on environmental tipping points. That will be a part of that, and that'll be an upcoming show. I don't want to go into it further because I want to hear what people have to say. But thank you, Alan, for calling.
Thanks.
Carl from New Jersey. Hi, Carl.
Hi. Hello?
Yes, hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Yeah. Gary, I grew up listening, and I grew up watching William F. Buckley interview people of very opposing views. And I've heard you say over and over again that it used to be that way, where people would get together and have people with different views would get together and have intelligent conversations. That's not happening anymore. And is there any way that could possibly happen again?
Yes, it could, and it should. Our principle is we never know what someone's going to say before they come on the air, because I never, ever, with no exceptions, pre-interview a single guest. So whatever their thoughts are, that's what they are. But
right.
It's also being able to provide a person a forum that otherwise would not have a forum and give them an opportunity uninterrupted to share their points of view. Then wherever you see an agreement or disagreement, you can offer a challenge. But what we have done in the United States in the media is the left only has on people who are the left, the right only people who are the right, and even when O'Reilly has someone on where it's a trashing and a bashing. What he does with Alan Combs is just, in my opinion, despicable. And it's no longer a reasonable dialogue.
It's show business.
It's blood sport.
It's like wrestling.
That's correct, and it shouldn't be. And also, when do you ever hear controversial topics discussed outside of the news stories that are in that immediate day's consciousness. I took a look yesterday at the Huffington Post and the New York Post and Fox and CNN, all of them including the BBC. With the exception of the BBC, that I consider the finest news service in the world, they were all the same, all covering the same stories. And I did not see a substantial difference in how they were covering. The trouble is you don't have forums today where people have a chance to share differences, and I believe we should have that. Thank you very much. I appreciate your input, Carl.
Thank you.
One quick call from Mike from Maryland. Mike, you're on.
Hi. My question is regarding if the U.S. government is in this position as it is, what's China's place going to be in the New World Order?
Okay, I'll do this. Tomorrow I will discuss the New World Order. I will discuss the transnational homeland security state and the decline of democracy when I begin a series that I will continue each day this week. I'll do that tomorrow. But now we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Noll, and this is One Place Where Divergent Opinions Have a Chance to Share a Point of View. Have a nice day, everyone.
Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.